Hello, I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. This is number 0523, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0523. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Rocky Lang, co-author of Letters from Hollywood, Inside the Private World of Classic American Movie Making.
Not only do we have great letters, you know, Hepburn and Mankiewicz and, you know, Wayne and Tom Hanks and Francis Coppola and Henry Fonda and Jane Fonda, I mean, go on and on and on and on, but it was not only finding those letters, but it was collecting those letters. So not only do we have to go to these archives, but I had to get the permission for the copyright to use the letters in the publication. What I thought, and which is wrong, is I thought I just needed to get the letter receiver to give me permission to use their letter. But it's the opposite. You have to get the copyright permission from the letter writer.
Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back talking about a very modern issue, that is cell phone addiction.
The reality of it is people spend so much time doing screen time, whether it's talking with acquaintances and friends and things like that, that we become addicted to the phone, and it's hard when we go sit down and have dinner with people to not be on our phone instead of being present with our friends and family.
Rachel Monroe is the author of Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Why is this a topic that so many women are into?
From talking to a bunch of different women and researching a number of different stories, it seemed to me that there are a few key motivations that keep coming up. Some women are motivated by really strong feelings of empathy, or they're drawn to stories of injustice. Some women are really fascinated by the dark side of human psychology. In a lot of cases, women have their own experience with trauma or with victimization, and they deal with it kind of by wanting to get closer to those stories, to learn more about them, that in a way that seems almost paradoxical makes them feel safer.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0523, was Ben O'Hara Byrne, anchor and producer at Czech News in Victoria, BC, and someone who has been all over the world as a foreign correspondent, someone I also used to work with many years ago in various newsrooms. Thank you very much, Ben, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A Wisconsin man who said he was trying to put out bed bugs with a cigarette accidentally set fire to his mattress in a Madison hotel. Guests were evacuated as firefighters responded. As firefighters entered the hotel, a manager notified them that the mattress had already been brought outside. They went outside to ensure the mattress was fully extinguished. A guest at the hotel explained to firefighters that he was trying to put out bed bugs with a cigarette when the mattress caught fire. The fire then activated an automatic sprinkler. Firefighters remained on scene until several rooms impacted by the smoke were fully cleared. Nobody was injured during the incident. The bedbugs did not survive. Okay, I'm willing to bet that this is yet another adult who is using childhood rhymes as a trigger. This is the risk you take when you tell a child, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite, just before you turn off the light and shut their bedroom door. Why would you make that the last thing they hear as their imagination runs wild in the dark? I mean, seriously. Okay, here's another variation of what has become an all too common story. 21-year-old David Schmidta of Sturbridge, Massachusetts, set out on August the 12th, determined to get rid of a hornet's nest three stories high under a corner of his family's roof. He first tried spraying the nest with Raid, But when that didn't work, he got creative. As his brother Matthew recorded video of the extermination, Dave lit a Roman candle and pointed the fiery balls at the nest. Now, the first two or three missed their mark, but when his ammunition connected with the nest, it burst into flames, killing the wasps, but setting the eaves on fire as well. Schmidta rushed up to a nearby window and used a fire extinguisher to put the flames out. "I would say mission accomplished," he said, even though there is now a small hole in his house. Wow. If he thinks that's mission accomplished, I hope he doesn't have a day job like auto mechanic, watch repair, or surgeon. Yeah. Three homes caught on fire in Newburgh Heights, Ohio, late Monday afternoon. The homes were all apparently owned by one person. The homeowner was using a blowtorch on some weeds around his house when his truck caught fire, exploded, and set the other homes ablaze. There were no injuries reported. Crews from several fire departments were responding to help extinguish the flames. Police are saying that there could be criminal liability in the case. Yeah, you can charge people with criminal offense, but unfortunately, you can't charge them with stupidity. And while we're still lighting things on fire, here's a word of advice. Don't leave your side chick hanging or she'll allegedly torch your home. That's what cops from Woodbury, New Jersey said happened to a man's house recently after he made a booty call to a woman and then he fell asleep, standing her up outside his home in the process. Seething, the woman, Taya Russell, allegedly sent heated texts to the unnamed man. "You wasted my money to come out here," Russell reportedly texted, which were later intercepted by police. "I see you wanna die." The victim told cops he woke up on August the 4th to 8 missed calls and texts from the woman, and his home was up in flames. Wearing only a t-shirt, the man reportedly ran almost half a kilometer from his flame-engulfed home to a police station. The man was covered head to toe in soot and ash when cops talked to him. He told cops that Russell was his side chick, whom he had had sexual relations with. Security cameras caught footage of Russell outside the man's home just prior to the fire, buying matches, lighter fluid, and a lighter at a nearby gas station. Firefighters managed to rescue the man's dog from the fire, but noted the home and its contents were completely destroyed. Russell was arrested on August the 5th and charged with attempted murder, aggravated arson, endangering, and criminal mischief. Now, not that I'm letting Russell off the hook by any means, but if you're referring to someone as your side chick, you are asking for trouble. Hell hath no fury like a horny woman scored. A horny woman who knows where to buy matches, lighter fluid, and a lighter. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in 2014, we had Rocky Lang on the show when he was promoting his book, Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul. Well, Rocky, who did grow up as the son of a mega film producer, is mining that territory again. He's the co-author of Letters from Hollywood, Inside the Private World of Classic American Movie Making. Rocky joins us via Skype from Los Angeles. Hi, Rocky.
Good morning from LA.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again, sir. Always a pleasure to have you on.
I love your program. We met on Confessions of Emergency Room Doctors.
Yes, that was a long time ago.
Which was one of the most fun interviews I've had. And then thank you for always being supportive of my efforts.
Well, thank you for putting out the stuff that you put out. So let's talk about Letters from Hollywood. How did this come to be? Because these are actual letters from Hollywood. I know you co-wrote this with someone else. You can talk a little bit about that. But how did this idea come to be in the first place?
It was quite by accident. I came home to get the mail one day, and there was a letter from the Motion Picture Academy. And I was sort of surprised to get it because although I'm a member of the Directors Guild, I'm not a member of the Academy. And so I opened it up, and it said, "Dear Rocky, you won't remember me, but my name is Howard Prouty, and I used to be an assistant librarian at the American Film Institute when you were a directing fellow." Now, that's going back to 1980. And so he said, "I'm now the acquisitions archivist at the Margaret Herrick Library, which is the library of the Academy. And he says, I found this letter that would be of interest to you. And I turn the page, and it's a letter from my father, Jennings Lang, and it's dated April 14th, 1939, and he was 24 years old, and he had just moved to Los Angeles with about $100 in his pocket and no job prospects, and he wanted to be an agent. And so he wrote this letter to a very famous literary agent named H.N. Swanson, who represented, you know, Gertrude Stein and F. Scott Fitzgerald and a number of, you know, great American 20th century writers. And I have no idea if the letter was ever returned, but what it did mark was the start of his career as a very powerful agent, where he represented Joan Crawford and Humphrey Bogart, and then went on to be a studio chieftain and a producer of 35 movies, including Earthquake and Airport, and Play Misty for Me, and a ton of other films. And, but the point of it is this, so this letter touched me in such a profound way that I called the archivist, Howard, and I said, hey, you know, can I take you to lunch? I can't tell you how important this is to me and my family. And at lunch, he then took me on a tour of the archives at the Academy, which, you know, I have no idea what the accurate numbers are, but I've heard as many as 12 million images and, you know, several million articles, including letters. And on the way home, I called my lit agent, and I told him I want to do a book called Letters from Hollywood and chronicle the film industry from the silent era to email. And he said, that's a great idea. And like all great ideas, then you have to realize how you're going to do this. And I realized, how the hell am I going to find these letters? I'm not a historian. I'm not an archivist. So I called back Howard, and he recommended a woman named Barbara Hall, who is a 30-year film historian. She's been an archivist at the Academy and another others' film libraries. And she knows pretty much everything that you could ever know about the history of Hollywood on every level, and knows, of course, where the archives are. So Barbara and I partnered up to do this book, and the two of us traveled all across the country. It was a 3-year journey, and the result is this book. And not only do we have great letters, you know, Hepburn and Mankiewicz and, you know, Wayne and Tom Hanks and Francis Coppola and Henry Fonda and Jane Fonda, I mean, go on and on and on and on. But it was not only finding those letters, but it was collecting those letters. And so not only do we have to go to these archives, and I looked in estate files and city offices and all sorts of crazy stuff, but I had to get the copyright permission, the permission for the copyright to use the letters in the publication. And what I thought, and which is wrong, is I thought I just needed to get the letter receiver to give me permission to use their letter. But it's the opposite. You have to get the copyright permission from the letter writer. So which meant if I found a letter from, let's say, you know, John Huston or Humphrey Bogart to John Huston.
Right.
And I find that letter in John Huston's file. I have to go search out the Bogart estate and get them to sign off on the letter. And what happened is that many of these, most of these letters had never been seen by their family or their estates, because they're issued by their parents or grandparents. And so they never saw them. And so their voices, the voices of their loved ones, are coming back in these letters. And so for the most part, everybody was really excited. And most of the times were you know, pretty routine in finding them. But there were a lot of letters, a number of letters that I couldn't find. I couldn't find the families of the states. They had either died out, or that they were off the grid, or that they didn't have any children, or their children, grandchildren changed names. And in a number of cases, I had to employ a private investigator to go on a deep search to turn up these people.
Wow.
And that in itself was really, really quite an adventure.
Now,
that's the answer. Sorry for the long response.
In putting this together, as you say, it started off with a letter that was sent to you, which was a kernel of an idea to want to do this. But in doing the research and putting the book together, you actually ended up with another letter that involved your dad.
That's right. I mean, the notorious story, or let us say the infamous story of my father, which actually was the genesis of the Billy Wilder film, The Apartment, was that my father was a young agent at the MCA agency, which, as your listeners may or may not know, ultimately took over Universal, became MCA Universal. But in the 50s, my dad had an affair with a screen siren named Joan Bennett. And Joan was married to a very well-known and respected producer named Walter Wanger, who did, other than Cleopatra and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a number of great films, you know, Riot and Cell Block 11 and I Want to Live with Susan Hayward, won the Academy Award. He'd done a lot of great films. And the Wanger marriage was in trouble, and my dad's marriage, before he met my mom, was in trouble. And so they had this affair in this apartment right around the corner from the MCA offices. And one day, my dad and Joan Bennett were returning from a meeting, and Walter Wanger was lying in wait and tried to shoot him in the balls. And that became the story. Jennings Lang was shot in the balls because he was shot and he nearly died. But he wasn't shot in the balls, or I wouldn't be here talking to you. But that's a great Hollywood rumor, and it went on. So to make this long story short, because it is a long story, there is a letter from screen actor Gilbert Rowland, who was a silent film star. He transitioned to talkies, and he wrote to the girl, Clara Bow, long after they had had an affair and done a number of movies. And so I had to find the family of Gilbert Rowland as a letter writer. And using my private investigator, we found a woman named Jill Rowland, who lived actually very close to me, and she was very insistent on meeting me before signing off the letter. And I read the letter over very closely, and I couldn't figure out why she was so insistent on meeting me. So I sent it to my friend David Sten, who wrote a book called Running Wild, which was about Clara Bow. And I said, could you source the letter and see what's in this letter that she wants to talk to me about? So he called me laughing. He says, well, this is all going back to you, because the CB in the letter is not Clarence, but Clara Bow, it's Constance Bennett. So now to follow me, Constance Bennett is Joan Bennett's sister. Constance Bennett was also an actress. Constance Bennett and Gilbert Rowland had two daughters, one named Jill Rowland. So David said, Jill's going to want to know if your father was shot in the balls. I said, that's ridiculous. Why would she want to do that? I didn't believe it, because Jill's in her 80s. And sure enough, we met at a coffee shop. And after a little bit of chit-chat, she asked me if my dad was shot in the balls. And of course, I said to her, I wouldn't be having lunch with you if I shot the balls. And so it was a very, very funny story. You know, it circled back. And there are a couple other instances where it circled back as well, but I won't tell you all those on a 10-minute piece. But that's just one of the crazy stories. And one of the other things that's really amazingly emotional about this thing is that I become friends with some of these kids who are now in their 80s and 90s. I mean, Bela Lugosi Jr. and Sarah Karloff. And Joel McRae's grandson, Wyatt. And so we share this fraternity of living in the shadows of greatness. But at the same time, we also saw the dark side of Hollywood. And so the sort of camaraderie we have together is really very special.
Now, this is a book, because I'm a fan of old Hollywood, this is a book that's of interest to me. But when you were putting something like this together, were you concerned that the audience you were trying to reach, or the audience that would be most susceptible to reading these stories, might be an audience that was, for lack of a better term, dying off?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And the key to this book, and it was the same to the key of my children's diabetes book, is that you can target a niche audience that is pretty robust, except that it doesn't really extend to the general population. So, Laura Takes Charge, which was my diabetes book, sold 40,000 copies out of my garage because there were no real books for children with diabetes at the time. In this book, there's a very rabid and very, excited, TCM crowd. And that if we can attack that crowd efficiently, then we will do well with the book. And because there are so many great names in the book and the letter content is so interesting, that we believe anybody who's interested in history, American history, cinema plays a big part. Film reflects culture, culture reflects film. Some of the same issues of morality and censorship, of which was there in the early part of the 20th century, and then then after the motion picture, the code was established, they got Trump down. We're still dealing with Trump today, talking about the evils of Hollywood. So there's a lot of sort of follow through over the centuries, and we're dealing with World War II, and we're dealing with the blacklist, and we're dealing with cultural things that happened that affected the lives of the letter writers and the letter receivers.
Well,
basically it has more interest than just the movies.
Okay. Well, we have less than a minute here, so I just want to ask you this question. Since it's such a personable thing that you've done here, and as you said, you've become friends with the heirs, the descendants of those that have written some of the letters, what would you think your father would say about this book?
I think I don't know that he would say anything other than, good job, Rock. I think that he would be fascinated by some of the stories in the letters because, there's always a story to some of the great movies, and some of these letters reveal this. And just in a very short, little tiny piece is that, there's a very short letter about the Bond movie, and it's, And Harry Saltzman, who was one of the original producers, had just had a meeting with Unitas Artists, and he sent a note to his partner, Albert Broccoli. And in the note, it says, just met with United Artists, and they think we can do much better than Connery. And so, you know, go look at what would have happened to James Bond without Sean Connery. And that's just a little teeny tidbit of, you know, 135 letters in the book, which are incredibly revealing and interesting on many levels.
The book is called Letters from Hollywood, Inside the Private World of Classic American Movie Making. Rocky, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Awesome. Always great to talk to you, and hope to catch up with you on one of the coasts soon.
Rocky Lang, co-author of Letters from Hollywood, Inside the Private World of Classic American Movie Making. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0523, and you'll find links to Rocky's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Dr. John Huber about telephone addiction. Plus, we'll meet the author of Savage Appetites. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff. Ontario Provincial Police say a man rolled through cow manure in an effort to evade police in Prince Edward County, Ontario. OPP alleged that the 23-year-old man was involved in an early morning collision and ran from the scene. They got reports around 1 a.m. of a gray vehicle found in a ditch and a man hiding in the bushes. Police say the man had rolled or crawled into cow manure while trying to evade officers. The man is facing several charges, including failure to stop after an accident and driving while under suspension. Of course, because they're always under suspension in these stories. You know, this is the second time this year we've had a story about someone trying to hide in manure from police. Do they think manure makes them invisible? And since this started as a car crash, would this be considered a moving violation? Yeah, I know, that was utterly ridiculous. An upscale neighborhood near the Ibis Golf and Country Club in West Palm Beach, Florida, is all aflutter over some unwelcome guests. Dozens of black vultures. A New York family can no longer visit the $700,000 vacation home they bought earlier this year. That's because the birds have defecated and vomited all around it, leaving a smell like 1,000 rotting corpses, claims homeowner Siobhan Casimano. Homeowner Cheryl Katz put out fake owls with moving heads and blinking red lights for eyes to scare off the birds, but she said the vultures ripped the heads off. Katz had to summon police when the vultures became trapped in her pool enclosure and attacked each other. Blood was everywhere, she said. Katz and other homeowners blamed the invasion on a neighbor who feeds wildlife, supplying bags of dog food, roasted chicken, and trays of sandwiches for their enjoyment. Neighborhood Association President Gordon Holness said the neighbor has been issued a warning, but the migratory birds are protected by federal law. Okay, what do you think? Is this a case of a neighbor really liking the vultures or really hating their neighbors? My vote is on the latter. Yeah. Band-Aids and gauze can help patch us up, but authorities in Orange County say one driver tried to repair his tires with them. Mission Viejo Police Services posted the pictures on Facebook. Deputies had responded to an emergency call at around 6 a.m. Tuesday from an alert citizen who noticed a suspicious man next to a parked vehicle. Deputies arrived to find both tires on the driver's side of the SUV were flat, and the 26-year-old man was trying to use gauze and Band-Aids to make repairs. Deputies arrested the man for being under the influence of drugs. Just to let you know, it's only because he was under the influence that this guy doesn't qualify for the idiot of the day. I guess he was concerned that his tires had a little boo-boo. If only those tires could sing.
I am stuck on Band-Aid Brand, Band-Aid stuck on me.
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an attempted burglary in Orinoco Township, Minnesota, unfolded in an unusual manner on August the 15th. Police responded to a burglary in progress call to find that alleged thief, 29-year-old Kirsten Hall, had scuffled with a 64-year-old woman before making off with pill bottles, debit and credit cards, $150 in cash, and a fake $1 million bill. Hart had run out of the house with part of her shirt ripped off, which led a passing motorist to ask if she was hurt and needed a ride. Hart accepted, climbing into the trunk of the car. The driver later told police he realized something wasn't right but panicked and drove off. Police also said they found iPads stolen from a local STEM school in the car Hart left behind. She and an accomplice face multiple charges. Okay, the part of this story that just boggles the mind for me is that unrelated driver who saw this half-naked woman on the street and offered to help her. If you were in this situation and offered to help this woman, wouldn't you be concerned if she said, "Yeah, pop the trunk"? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Are you suffering from phoneliness? According to a new study, phone addiction causes loneliness, anxiety, and depression. Oh, you know I have to talk about this with Dr. John Huber. He's a clinical forensic psychologist and the chairman of Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. He joins us once again on the line from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. Hope you're doing well.
Always trying, anyway. this story about phone addiction, and I know we've discussed various types of addiction in the past. This study has taken place. In your estimation, is this a real thing? I'm not talking about the addiction. I'm talking about the study itself.
Yes, actually, it is. And you know, there's been several similar studies we mentioned before, but this is a real thing. I mean, the reality of it is, people spend so much time doing screen time, whether it's talking with acquaintances and friends and things like that, that we become addicted to the phone, and it's hard when we go sit down and have dinner with people to not be on our phone instead of being present with our friends and family.
Now, I'm sure you've seen it quite often, people walking down the street, heads buried in a phone, even while they're walking, not even watching where they're going. My question is, when somebody is doing this, and you see a 40-year-old, a 50-year-old doing this, someone who clearly could not have grown up with a phone in their hand, and you see them doing this, is this more of a problem for the generation which literally grew up with a phone?
It tends to be more of a problem with them. It's a problem for all of us because the same neurochemical pathways and mechanisms are at play that cause us to keep our head down while we're trying to cross the street watching the phone instead of watching out for cars that are going to hit us.
We often talk about the fact that an addictive personality is just that, someone who can be addicted to something easily. So
yes.
is it possible that this problem goes beyond just mere addiction? Because we see people who would, in most cases, live a normal life. They're not addicted to anything, be it pills or alcohol or video games or whatever. But when it comes to the phone, there seems to be no stopping. What is it about the addiction or the possible addiction to a cell phone that seems to be stronger than others?
Okay, here's the thing. There's a lot of stuff going on here. I'll try to keep it simple.
Sure.
But it's the reason why even people who are typically addiction resistant fall into this. One of the things, we're social animals. We are reinforced for communing with other social animals like ourselves, and even some that aren't ourselves, like our puppies or horses and bunnies and things like that. But when it comes to humans, we need human contact. Physiologically, our body releases lots of different hormones, including oxytocin, even in men, when you're with people that you like and you shake their hands and you hug them. You get all these neurochemicals that actually help our body and our brain work better. We also get serotonin, norepinephrine, and the addiction king of all hormones, neurotransmitters, dopamine. And that's what is getting released with our cell phones. We get dopamine release. We don't get any of the other neurotransmitters, but the dopamine makes us feel good for a micro instant. And then you start feeling a little bit lonely, and you text a friend, and they text you back, and you get another bump of dopamine. And it's real subtle. It's exactly the same mechanism that happens when you inject a line of heroin or snort a line of coke. That dopamine's getting released at a much lower pace. So it's very insidious. It's very, like, clandestine. You don't even realize it's happening. That's why addictive resistant people become addicted to their cell phones, because it's slow building. And by the time it's happened, you don't even know it's happened. And cell phone, I've used this before, is much like drinking a diet soda. You get a good sweet taste, your tummy gets full, but there's no nutritional value in it all. With cell phones, you get the dopamine, but you get none of the other neurotransmitters and hormones that actually nurture and feed our body. But you get the one that makes you feel good. And phone designers, the people who make the social media apps, the video games, and believe it or not, our instant news cycle, they know this, and they are great at behavior management, and they control our behavior and make us want more. And we get stuck on that phone.
It's interesting that you say that, because I was just about to ask, back in the days when we were so concerned about simple cigarette smoking, there was the story and the theories coming out that the people making cigarettes knew exactly what they were doing and how addictive they were. Are you now saying that people who actually make phones and the business of making apps that these phones use are also aware of that property?
I'm telling you, today they're aware of it. They weren't, you know, when smartphones hit the ground in 2007, 12 years ago, they didn't really know it. They didn't, you know, we had ideas and we thought, okay, stimulus response, it's like a Pavlovian thing. Well, it's much more than that. And they know it now. And the thing is, you know, media, you know, when you were owned a newspaper back in the day, you had subscribers and you sold advertisement based on the number of subscribers. So you didn't have to push, for example, mass shootings, you know, but they happened. They were on the third page. They were on the second page. They were on section D, first page, whatever. Now they get paid by click-throughs. So they put an addictive, blood-curdling, gut-wrenching title for a story that they published. It may not have anything to do, actually, with what's in the story itself. But you click on that, and they get a half a cent from this advertiser and a half a cent from that advertiser. That's how they get paid. So they are reinforced to do this.
Yeah, but you're talking about how it wasn't necessarily that way in the newspaper world. I'm going to disagree a little bit. I think it exactly was like that in the newspaper world, because that's where the term "if it bleeds, it leads" comes from.
Right, but that's like, you know, playground stuff compared to what's going on now.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
I mean it is. And now these people know it. The makers know it, and they're great. They, you know, these computer programs know what it takes, the programmers, to get people to
to continue to stick with their games and their apps and all that kind of stuff. And they're genius at it. And they became very good at human behavior and how to get human behavior to like their games and like their apps. And without knowing it, they became behavioralists. Now, the research is coming out, and these guys know what's going on. They don't necessarily understand the biochemistry and the neurology and all this kind of stuff, but they know how it works better than most people, because most people watching those apps and on their phone aren't going to go click and read something like this.
Okay, so as you say, it's an insidious situation. I would assume it's very similar to other addictions. At least in the early stages, people aren't aware of the fact that they are addicted. So, having said that, how do you get past this? I mean, are you going to require phone a friend interventions, or how can someone
Skype me and then use my app? Okay, and then.
How can someone know that they have a concern, or is it up to others to realize concerns in either a loved one or a child or whatever the case may be?
Well, that's what you need to look at. If you can't put your phone down for a dinner with your family, you got a problem. And I recommend when you do business dealings, you want to impress the business person you're trying to do business with, walk out, pull that cell phone out, set it on the table so everybody can see it, and turn it off. That sends a message. You're more important than anybody on that cell phone. You want to make a deal, that will impress those people, because we know in unconsciously how difficult that is to do. And if you can do that, that will increase your sales. You watch. Trust me, all you advertising people out there and business people, try it. You'll be surprised. Now, what I recommend you do is, honestly, there are some simple apps you can get that turns your phone into a phone only. No more social media apps, all that kind of stuff. And if you have to live by your phone, you're a salesman, you're a doctor, whatever, use one of those apps. Now, I usually have them use it on their kids' phones, so their kids, you know, they can control what their kids are doing. Use it on yours for a week. Go cold turkey on all these apps, except use your phone as a phone for a week. And then after that, one day a week, you take an app break off your phone where it still works as a phone, but you're not going to look up Google. You're not going to go check the address of that restaurant. Use your phone as a phone one day a week, and you'll be surprised. Now, I put my money where my mouth is. Last summer, I took 60 days off.
Wow.
60 days off. Now, I use my phone for business. I use my phone for my website, my social media that is associated with my nonprofit, and I have to be out there. So in that case, you know, I'm lucky. I have people in my office, and I just assign them different apps, and this person did Twitter. This one did, you know, whatever is out there,
Instagram.
It's the yellow one.
Instagram.
Yeah. Instagram, exactly, and Facebook and all these different things. And I didn't do any of those. And it's crazy when I come back. Now the number one thing I do in the morning is I go up and I see who my friends are on Facebook having birthdays, and I wish them a happy birthday. And then that's about 90% of what I do on social media.
As long as you didn't mention MySpace. The one thing...
I'm not that old. What are you talking about?
The one thing I want to ask very quickly, which is totally unrelated, and it's because you mentioned earlier the fact that we are social creatures, and that's one of the reasons we can be addicted to our phones. Is it also the same for, say, the social alcoholic? Because sometimes people don't drink alone. They use drinking as an excuse to be around people in pubs and bars. Could that be the same situation as you were talking about with phones earlier?
Yes, or they're using being around people as an excuse for drinking.
Okay.
Then it makes it okay. Otherwise, they use their own social skills and their own personal control to keep from drinking.
And for the record, I have no problem with a cell phone because mine's a flip phone. So there you go.
Awesome.
John, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, Peter. You're amazing. I love your show. And thanks for keep calling and coming back to me.
Well, I will if you keep your phone on.
I got an app for that.
Okay.
Let me hook you up.
Dr. John Huber, Chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0523, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Savage Appetites. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Police in Indiana said a driver was ticketed when a dirty diaper tossed out of a window by a backseat passenger struck a trooper's car. Indiana State Police Sergeant Stephen Wheelis said he was on Interstate 65 in Johnson County when a soiled diaper flew out from the backseat window of a car in front of him and bounced off his squad car. I was heading home after working the Indiana State Fair, tired, and wasn't really expecting it, Wheelis said. It hit my car and bounced a couple of times. It's not something I could really let fly. Wheelis ticketed the driver. His patrol car was not damaged. I'm sorry. Shouldn't that warrant an arrest? I don't think a ticket is enough. Quick side story here, by the way. As a teenager, I worked at a drive-in theater, and one of the jobs we used to have at the drive-in is the next morning after the movies, we would drive around with a front-end loader and pick up any trash that people had left behind. You'd be surprised how many people would toss their dirty diapers out of the window and leave that behind. It was a gooey mess, especially when it might have rained overnight. Oh, Lord, what a biohazard that is. Again, that should warrant an arrest, not just a ticket. That's just my personal thought. Anyway, the big mouth bass can step aside. A woman fishing in upstate New York snapped photos when she reeled in a trout with a unique feature, two mouths. Debbie Geddes said she was fishing on Lake Champlain with her husband when she reeled in a two-mouthed fish. Photos of the unusual trout went viral after a friend, Adam Factow, posted them on Facebook. I've had messages from all over the world, like people asking about this fish, and it seems like everybody's got an opinion on what is the cause of this fish having two mouths, Factow reported. Theories from people who viewed the photos include a genetic mutation and an injury from a swallowed hook. Getty said she released the fish back into the water after taking the photos. Okay, with all the theories coming up, did anyone consider the possibility that there might be, oh, I don't know, a chemical plant near the water somewhere? If I caught a fish with two mouths, I would consider my fishing in that water source officially over. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Journalist Rachel Monroe is the author of Savage Appetites, four true stories of women, crime, and obsession. In the book, she examines why so many women are fascinated and obsessed by true crime stories and real-world whodunits. Rachel joins us on the line from Texas. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So I'll just ask the question right off the bat. Why is it, since you did this book and you've studied this, why is it that women seem to be fascinated and obsessed with true crime stories and real world whodunits?
Well, I don't think that there's one simple answer. That's why I had to write a whole book about it. But I think that from talking to a bunch of different women and researching a number of different stories, it seemed to me that there are a few key motivations that keep coming up. Some women are motivated by really strong feelings of empathy, or they're drawn to stories of injustice. Some women are really fascinated by the dark side of human psychology. And in a lot of cases, women have their own experience with trauma or with victimization, and they deal with it kind of by wanting to get closer to those stories, to learn more about them. That, in a way that seems almost paradoxical, makes them feel safer.
Well, you know, it's often been said that when it comes to men and women, women look at women, men look at women rather, and hope that they never change. And women look at men and hope that they will change. So that being said, do you think some women are attracted to the type of people you're talking about in these stories because they figure, you know, if I were involved with this guy, I could turn him around?
Sure. Well, so there are many different flavors of the fascination with true crime, and there is a small subset of women who do become romantically attached in some way to famous murderers. But, you know, and I think there is that fantasy of, you know, I'll be the one special woman. I can, he'll love me. He hates the world. He hates humanity, but maybe he'll love me. But I also kind of see those women as they're just a mirror to the rest of our culture. Our culture, we live in a culture that's so fascinated with murderers. You know, even if we pretend to condemn them, we pay so much attention to them. And so that kind of makes you question whether it really is a condemnation or not.
Well, what led you to this topic in the first place?
I think it was interest, curiosity about my own self. I'm a pretty friendly, nice, peaceful, nonviolent person, and yet whenever I was stressed out or flipping through the channels on the TV, I was drawn to these incredibly dark stories. And it wasn't just me. You know, my mom and I, we get together and we talk about serial killers, and you know, my father would have to like leave the room because it would disturb him so much. And I just didn't quite understand that part of my own psychology. And I knew that I wasn't alone. I knew that this was something that a lot of people, these stories, a lot of people were drawn to them. And so I just wanted to try to think about why that might be.
And now that you've delved into it, do you know your psychology any better? Or did it just create more questions?
Well, it did create more questions, but I did come to realize that just thinking back at my own life, it was often in periods when I felt kind of stressed out or anxious about other things in the world that these stories were particularly appealing to me. And I think maybe that's because true crime, there are stories about like one bad guy often. And if you catch the bad guy, then the problem is solved. And there's something really satisfying about that, and almost soothing in a strange way, even though these stories are about the dark side of humanity and the terrible things that people do. When they have that promise of closure, I think that can suit a person who's feeling stressed out about other bigger problems.
Well, tell us what we'll learn by reading Savage Appetites.
Well, you'll learn about the four women who I researched in writing this book, each of whom has a different approach, each of whom became really fascinated with and obsessed with a crime that didn't happen to her, and hopefully through them, maybe get a little bit of perspective on yourself if these stories are things that fascinate you. And there's all sorts of little hidden asides in the book, like a little bit of a history of forensic science, which we all know now from CSI and all those TV shows, of course, but there's I write about a woman who was an heiress at the turn of the last century, who was a grandmother, but became totally fascinated with this new forensic science, this new way to use crime or use science to solve crimes. Most people have no idea that like a nice grandmother from Chicago really helped pioneer that field. So there are a lot of fun asides about subjects like that.
Judging by the conversations you said you were having with your mom, how much did she enjoy vicariously living through you in your research for this book?
Well, I did share some of the more troubling aspects. It's good to have somebody in your life who doesn't judge you if you've got kind of a dark mind, somebody who you don't feel like you need to censor yourself for. So I did dedicate the book to my mother for that reason.
Just recently, just a couple of weeks ago, we hit the 50th anniversary or mark of the Manson murders. And I understand one of the people you talk about in your book has a connection to the Manson family murders.
She sure does. The woman that I write about, Lisa Statman, in the 1990s, she moved into the house where Sharon Tate was murdered. And through a very complicated, twisty series of events, she both became an important figure in the victims' rights movement, which is a political movement that emerged in some ways out of those Manson family murders. And she also became romantically involved with a member of Sharon Tate's family. And it's really fascinating how those crimes just haven't left us as a cultural touchstone. You know, it's a half century on, and they still really have a shape our culture in some ways. And she's a real example of that.
And one of the other ones talk about is a teenager in 2015 who is deeply involved in being an online fan of the Columbine killers.
Yeah, isn't that wild? I think a lot of people don't realize that this subculture exists online, but it's a fairly thriving world online of young people, primarily young women, who profess love for, in this case, those two school shooters who committed the Columbine massacre. And the woman that I wrote about did become fascinated with those crimes, so much so that she ended up planning a mass shooting of her own.
Wow. Does it give you any pause when you work on a book like this and now it's out and it's being publicized that you might be part of a situation where someone fantasizes about some of the things you write about in your book?
Oh, wow. You know, I hadn't actually worried about that until you mentioned it. Now I'll worry about it. I think one interesting thing about working on a book like this is you realize how there are these aberrant cases that are really alarming and scary, but most crime isn't the way it's depicted on CSI. Most crime is people hurting people close to them and crimes of opportunity and white collar crime and that kind of thing. So that it's good to working on a book like this really sort of demystifies some of those cultural myths about, you know, serial killers and things like that, which are actually people are very rare.
So
thank goodness
it hasn't done the opposite. Then you don't now stand there in the mall looking around at people differently since you've done all this research.
Well, you know, I did have a period when I was working on that section about the girl who planned the mass shooting. I spent a long time reading her writing and reading her chats with a boy that she planned the mass shooting with, and spending that much time in somebody's mind who's fantasizing about committing violence against strangers. I think there's no way for it to not affect you. And so I did found myself getting kind of paranoid and anxious during that period, but hopefully it's left me behind a little bit.
In doing the research, did you have a chance to talk to people like police psychologists or anybody who would delve into the psyche of some of the people you're writing about?
I have in the past for other stories that I was working on. But, you know, in this case, I was really trying to avoid writing about the criminals themselves. There's a lot of cultural space given to them, and I was trying to take a different angle and to examine why these crimes are so... or why these stories are so fascinating to people and not so much, not lingering so much on the brains of the bad guys themselves.
The book is called Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Is it fair to say that it's a book that can be read by everyone, not just women?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, some of my favorite fans are men.
Great. Rachel, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Rachel Monroe, author of Savage Appetites, Four True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0523, and you'll find links to Rachel's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And now it's time for that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A burglary suspect accused of scuffling with a Holly Hill, Florida homeowner left behind a motel room key. Officers responded to a garage burglary at a residence shortly after 6 a.m. The homeowner told police he saw a man, later identified as 21-year-old Keelix Moon, inside his garage when he went to take out the trash. The homeowner confronted Moon, who pushed him to the ground. Moon ran from the garage with a scooter, a skateboard, and a gas-powered weed eater. The motel room key Moon left behind led police to room 9 at the Twilight Motel. Inside the room, police found Moon and his girlfriend, Izetta Pierce. After getting permission to search the room, police found the scooter and skateboard inside. The weed eater was found outside the room. Moon was taken into custody and charged with occupied burglary, grand theft, and battery. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're committing a robbery, would you leave your motel room key, which everybody knows is always a walking advertisement for said establishment, at the scene of the crime? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0523. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0523. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp Singapore and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.